Welcome to the VA Tourism Podcast, and I'm Kojo Benton Williams. The VA Tourism Podcast is dedicated to Africa's travel and tourism industry, where leaders from the private and public sectors get to talk to us. You can subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, TuneIn, and Google Podcasts. In the wake of the environmental disaster in the beautiful Indian Ocean island of Mauritius, where 4,000 tons of oil have been spilled in this world-renowned coral reefs, our guest, Dr. Nirmal Shah, the CEO of Nature Seychelles and marine purist, will help us understand the vital nature of the marine ecosystem in our lives. Good afternoon and welcome to the VA Tourism Podcast. And my guest today is Dr. Nirmal Shah, CEO of Nature Seychelles, and he's going to help us understand, you know, the marine ecosystem in Africa and also the importance of marine to our lives, you know, and what's happening right now in Seychelles, where a Japanese, you know, ship have been spilling over 3,000 tons of oil on the beautiful coast of Seychelles. Thank you, sir. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
Okay. Actually, I mean, it's always a pleasure and, insightful to be talking to you. But give us a brief of how, you know, the marine ecosystem with the history of Africa and the Indian Ocean, and how important it is to our lives.
Yeah. So the marine ecosystem has always played not only an important role, but I think a vital role in all the nations and civilizations on the coast. The maritime traffic in particular has been so important in trade and in colonization as well. The Arabs, the Europeans, but prior to that, the Indonesians, who sailed all the way from Indonesia to colonize Madagascar and bringing food crops and so forth from the Far East. And obviously, more recently, we've seen the emergence of the blue economy, which is, as a concept, encompasses maritime security, maritime trade, marine tourism, marine ecology, conservation, and so forth. Fisheries, obviously, more sustainable fisheries. So I think for the countries on the eastern and southern African border and in the Western Indian Ocean, the marine environment is so vital to us. I mean, without it, we would not exist. And obviously, also the Indian Ocean plays a critical role in climate regulation. We've seen that recent research has shown that the Indian Ocean, being a very small ocean, stores a lot of heat. And because it stores a lot of heat, we will see quite a lot of expansion in cyclonic activity. And for example, the Seychelles Islands, which were never in the so-called cyclonic belt, will be hit by cyclones or cyclonic type activity very soon.
Okay, no, thank you. Now, you've done extensive work on marine and the blue economy. Okay, can you tell us how Africa is doing in terms of that?
Yes, so what the problem with the blue economy is that many countries, it's a pity that many of our neighboring countries are using the blue economy label as old wine in a new bottle. So they're putting a new label on business as usual. So this is not the point of the blue economy. The point of the blue economy is to bring a new sort of vision to the marine ecosystem. And the vision is largely to do with sustainability, with equity, and with democracy. So, which in many parts of our continent, are not there. Like, for example, there was a recent paper published by one of my colleagues, which shown that a lot of components of what is called the blue economy in this part of the world are really just business as usual. You know, people or governments trying to redo ports and harbors in the same old way and not taking into consideration the communities or even climate change. So I think that there's huge amount of economic activities to do with the oceans, but to call a lot of it blue economy, I think, is misleading. And I think some government, as I said, are simply using it as a new sort of mantra or label to get financing and to get attention.
Okay, no, that's interesting where the conversation is now heading towards. Now, if we look at what's happening right now with the pandemic and all of that, there have been a lot of conversation how the pandemic seemed to have swallowed other sectors of, you know, of our lives. And I've seen a couple of articles that you've authored, and in one of them you talk about maybe why it is important now to pay more attention to that. Can you throw more light on that?
Yes. We know that the pandemic emerged from what I call a twisted relationship with nature, that all these so-called zoonotic diseases, or the diseases that move from animals to humans, sometimes extremely quickly, as we've seen with the COVID-19 crisis, are because humans are destroying natural ecosystems and having this incredibly destructive relationship with wildlife. We've seen that the whole COVID-19 pandemic started with the wet markets in China. And we've seen also in the past similar sort of epidemics, like with Ebola, like with SARS, like with MERS, all starting in the same sort of way. So I think, first of all, it's extremely important that as soon as we get a handle on this current crisis, which I think we will, we must re-examine our relationship with nature. It must not be forgotten. All these types of wet markets, for example, the illegal trade in wildlife, the consumption of bush meat in our continent and so forth, have to really be re-examined and actually stopped. A lot of these practices have to be stopped. So that's one. Two, I think that we as a continent here in Africa, we are not properly prepared for sudden shocks, because most of our governments are trying to deal with day-to-day crises. And a sudden shock that comes like this, we're just not prepared. Thirdly, it shows also the integration of the world system of globalization. We're so globalized now, it's like the butterfly flaps its wing in China and the Seychelles is affected. So that's the other thing that we need to start looking at, that we need to start looking at more local and regional supply chains, more local and regional food systems and so forth.
Okay. Now let's come to the unfortunate situation in Mauritius, and whether you think Mauritius should have been better prepared to manage a situation like this. What's your take on that?
Yes, so definitely Mauritius should have been better prepared, and the reason is this. Since the early 90s, in 91, I was involved in the development and planning and rollout of the Seychelles contingency oil spill contingency plan. And this is when I was in government. Even when I left government, I was still on the oil spill contingency plan board, so to speak. Now, Mauritius was designated as a regional oil spill contingency center. And quite a lot of money was poured into this region and into Mauritius in the first instance back in the 90s. From Canada and from the US, but later through the World Bank, there was a very large project, I think, which amounted to almost $4 million from 1999 to 2005, if I remember correctly, to set up this huge regional center in Mauritius and to equip it with the idea that if Seychelles, for example, had an oil spill and we needed booms or we needed chemicals or we needed technical assistance, that could be flown in from Mauritius. So all this stuff has been going on. And more recently, under the United Nations Environment Program, under the regional convention called the Nairobi Convention, there's been quite a lot of work going on through a project called Sapphire and through the Nairobi Convention itself. So I'm quite baffled that the ship came ashore and was allowed to stay there for a while. This we know there was quite bad weather, so that may have been difficult. But that Mauritius is experiencing so much logistical issues and so much planning issues, that is a bit sort of puzzling.
Now, if your whole country, Seychelles, and giving me the background of this, how are we prepared now to manage future disasters like this? I mean, like this.
Well, I think the main problem is that although the Seychelles and Mauritius obviously have an oil spill contingency plan, these sort of oil spills don't happen frequently. In fact, okay. They're quite rare. So I think what is happening is that people have changed, the authorities responsible for the oil spill contingency planning may have changed, equipment may have become obsolete or rusted or rotted. That's the issue. So I think that this huge oil spill, which is threatening protected areas, in particular the Îles Aigrettes island, which is quite similar to the island my organization manages here in Seychelles, Cousin Island. I think that this is a wake-up call for all of us in the region that, yes, we don't have oil spills normally, but when they come suddenly, and they may come as a very large event that may overtake our capacity to deal with it all of a sudden. So we really need to keep on plugging away at this oil spill contingency planning and rollout.
Okay, can we digress a bit to look at how, for example, over tourism is seemingly threatening some of these marine ecosystems, and yes. What's tourism's role in protecting that?
Yeah, so the fine balance. My organization, Nature Seychelles, was the first one in Seychelles to actually raise the red flag about over-tourism 2 years ago, because the island we manage, which is the Cousin Island Special Reserve, which is very famous for its conservation, but also for its ecotourism program, which has been running since 1972, we recorded in 2018 a huge increase in tourism. It jumped to 26% more than the average of the last 10 years. So that was a red flag to us. And as you know, we spoke to you and to other people all over the world about this. But now we have a situation where from over-tourism, we've gone to no tourism. So it's really a huge sort of dichotomy where we were complaining about too many tourists. Now we don't have tourists. And not having tourists in a country like Seychelles is disastrous, because although it forms only 35% or 37% of GDP, it brings in over 75% of the foreign currency. And being a small island state where we import everything or almost everything we need, this is a disaster. And for myself and for Nature Seychelles and for other organizations which manage protected areas, all our revenues for our recurrent budgets come from tourism. So now we have an issue where not only is the country suffering, but all the conservation gains of the last 20 or 30 years are being eroded. We see poaching, we see people, our staff unable to do the sort of monitoring and research and even surveillance of some of these protected areas. So yes, because we've managed to be quite successful in marrying conservation with tourism, we now are also the victims of that, because now it's a divorce. Tourism has divorced us and we are left alone as conservationists. And we can't exist without that partnership.
Okay, no, that's interesting, but I don't think that tourism will like divorce that conservation. Now, if you look at exactly, but you know, let's stay on this in a particular subject. And if you look at other definitions of theories of over tourism, what is Nature Seychelles's definition of that? Because sometimes we're looking at, for example, having a destination like Seychelles, and then assuming a lot of the traffic is at Dennis Island or Prally, where you can spread the numbers, you know. So necessarily sometimes there's always a conflicting argument on, you know, the number of people in a particular destination as opposed to the attractions. What's your take on that?
Yeah, so that's an excellent question, and it's a question that we need actually a debate on, because I think that's the crux of the problem, the definition of over-tourism. And the definition of over-tourism is also a moving target, okay? I don't mean to change the goalpost, but it's a moving target, simply because over-tourism, as we define it, in a sensitive area like Kuze Island Special Reserve, may not be the same as, let us say, Grand Bay in Mauritius. So we defined it as this. One, it started to surpass our management ability to handle so many visitors. And we have a complex visitation system where we have to land all the visitors ourselves from their boats. So it started to become too difficult for our staff to handle so many tourists. That's one. Two, the tourism experience for the tourists themselves, the visitor experience, started to diminish because there were too many visitors at the same time on the trails. Thirdly, I think is we started to see, not a lot, but we started to see a sort of impact on the biodiversity. But that is much less of an impact than the impact on human beings, the management system itself and the tourists themselves. So that's how we defined it. And we wanted to, we didn't want no tourism, but we wanted to manage it so as to maintain the integrity of our management systems on the special reserve. Now, over tourism in Seychelles, you can expand that definition to say, fine, we've been getting 300 times the number of tourists in Seychelles than the population of Seychelles. So that itself starts to make people wake up. Because if you look at Mauritius with 1 million tourists, it's still not equivalent to the population of Mauritius. So that's one. Two, yes, we can stretch it to various islands, but they still, most of them, or if not all of them, still have to go through the main island, which is Mahé. Then you start talking about infrastructure. Is the airport big enough to handle that? We've already seen, and I suffer from that when I go to Prale Island to go to Cousin. There's absolutely no parking at the airport left anymore, although they've expanded the parking. There'll be more tour buses on the road, so there'll be more traffic jams, there'll be more car hires on the road. And one of our biggest problems in Seychelles is that, as you know, we're highly dependent or heavily dependent on foreign labor. So one third of our total labor force here in Seychelles, tourism included, is expatriate workers. So the more you expand tourism, the more you will need foreign workers with all their issues and whatnot. So I think that we need to have a debate on this, and we need to actually
must be a very difficult fine balance, a precarious line.
Yeah, that's correct. That's correct. But I think at the moment, no government in this part of the world wants to talk about it, because we're trying to now to revive tourism.
Of course,
certainly. But that's also an opportunity. It's an opportunity to actually go towards more sustainable tourism, more
they say build back better.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, so what would you tell the traveler, you know, in terms of their own, the ethics that they have to, you know, uphold in traveling to destinations like, you know, like Seychelles and other, you know, marine dominated attractions? What they ought to do and ought to keep the system running?
Sure. So the first thing is to, because we have pretty strict laws, so the first thing is to understand that Seychelles is a conservation champion, which I think all the tourists know, and that's primarily the reason why they come here, or most of them. Secondly, that very fragile environment, the Sishawa depend very heavily on the marine environment, that people actually should ask questions when they go to restaurants or when they go fishing and whatnot. They have to ask the operators, is this activity sustainable? Is this activity licensed by the government or permitted by the government? So those are questions that I've seen discerning travelers ask in other destinations, and they should actually ask this here. Also, we would like to see more and more travelers supporting conservation initiatives, okay, so that they actually go to the Vallée de Mai, they come to Kuzen Island, they go to these other places which are nature reserves and national parks, because as I said, all our revenues are dependent on tourism. So it's very important for tourists to know that a lot of the money that they spend here in Seychelles actually goes to preserving this amazing environment.
Okay, as we wrap up, I would like for you to tell us more about yourself. Who is Dr. Nimal Shah? What the work you've been doing at Nature Seychelles, and then you may want to cap up with the 30% allocation of marine for your economic zone. As you wrap up.
Sure. So I started out as a conservationist very, very young, probably at the age of 10 or even younger. Because my father, although he was a very successful business person, he was also a conservationist, he was an environmentalist, he was a folklorist, a man in love with Seychelles, very well-known historian. He used to cure himself with natural herbs and whatnot. So I grew up in this household. And at the time when foreign scientists came here, because we didn't have scientists here in the Seychelles. So all these scientists came from overseas to do work on these amazing island ecosystems. They would all hang out with him, come and stay with him. And I would meet all these amazing scientists and go out in the field with them. So at the age of 10, I was going out in the field with, you know, top coral reef ecologists, with botanists, with all kinds of amazing researchers. So that's where it started. And I think by the age of 13, I could tell you the scientific name of any fish or shell from the Seychelles. And so that's where it carried on. And I went to university, I got my PhD, I came back, I started to work in fisheries. So I became the assistant director of fisheries to do with research. And after that, the president of Seychelles, the then president, asked me to set up the country's first conservation and national park service, which I became the first director of. And we started to do quite a lot of work, which had never been done, because you must remember that we were a British colony until 1976. So we had quite a lot of work to do here to bring all our conservation systems up to scratch. So that took up a huge amount of my time. Then I left government and started the Seychelles' first consultancy firm to do with environment, marine resources, and sustainable development, called Enviro, Environment, Resources, Oceans. And I did environmental impact assessments. I did national park management plans. I did the Seychelles' first ozone depletion substance plan. So it was amazing. That was an amazing time for me, because every project I took on as a consultant had a learning curve with it. It was nothing that I had studied at university. So I learned a lot. I met a lot of people. And yeah, and it was profitable as well. Then BirdLife International wanted to open up a partner here, a BirdLife partner here. They asked me to set it up. And that became, from BirdLife Seychelles, it became Nature Seychelles. So that's where I am today. And we've been responsible for the rescue of some of the most endangered birds in Seychelles. We have an amazing education program, and we've won awards for our education program. We've introduced curricula in the schools. We've trained 500 teachers almost. And we are now doing one of the world's largest coral reef restoration projects. Yes, so we are still going on, even though COVID-19 has hit us. And we are quite optimistic, although revenues are down because there's no tourism.
Okay. Thank you so much, Doc. And it's been a wonderful conversation, insightful, opening our eyes to the openings of what's been happening in the area of the blue economy and marines. Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
All right. Thank you.